Before we get into this week's episode, we have a really exciting announcement to make. Spike's incredible internship program is back. We're on the lookout for an aspiring journalist to join our team for a 6-month paid full-time placement. You'd be working with us here in the Spiked office, doing everything from helping us put out our articles to helping us produce podcasts like this one. And you don't need any prior experience to apply. What we're looking for is someone who has a spark for journalism, writing, or podcasting, and who has a passion for our pro-freedom, pro-human message. Everything else you can learn on the job. I started at Spiked as an intern, so I can highly recommend applying for this. It's an amazing experience, and you get to earn while doing something you love. There really is nowhere better to kickstart your career in journalism. To find out more and to apply, go to spiked-online.com/interns. That's spiked-online.com/interns. You have until Sunday, the 19th of May, to apply. Good luck. Hello, and welcome back to the Spike podcast. I'm Lauren Smith, standing in for Fraser this week. And joining me in the studio today is Spike's editor, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And Spike columnist, Ella Whelan.
Hi.
On today's episode, we'll be discussing the revelations from the Cass report, Britain's broken asylum system, and Westminster's honey trap scandal. A whole 4 years on from when the Cass review was first commissioned, we finally have seen the end result of this, this review. And essentially, at its core, it says a lot of the things that gender critical voices have been saying for some time now. But Tom, what can we take from this? What does this all mean?
I think we can take from it a tremendous vindication of a lot of the arguments and a lot of the points that gender critical campaigners were making for a very long time. There has been this attempt to downplay the impact of this report, which we'll get into. But across the scale, it's just demonstrated that what was presented as gender affirming care was not only not helping these children. I think that there's a heavy implication now. The question we have to ask is how much was it actually harming them? But all of the kind of the pillars of what we were told was such essential care for these confused young people, puberty blockers, as you say, this report showing, as has already been known, that there is no reliable evidence to suggest that these work in terms of relieving gender distress, gender dysphoria. The evidence base for that is incredibly weak. Similarly, same for cross-sex hormones, as you say. I mean, Cass even goes as far as to suggest that cross-sex hormones, clinicians should use extreme caution when prescribing them to kids who are 16 and over, which they're currently available to. And of course, puberty blockers are already banned in the NHS in the vast, vast majority of cases as a consequence of Cass's investigation. There's even stuff in there on social transitioning. So this the practice of changing names, pronouns, presenting as the opposite sex before even taking any drugs or engaging in any treatment. There's even suggestion that there's no evidence that it helps or hinders, and that there's even some suggestions that it might lead a child to be more likely to go down the medical pathway. So that's the story that you see again and again. There's no evidence to back up this treatment. What we do know is that it might nudge them further towards this medical pathway. And given the fact that at the end of this medical pathway is oftentimes someone losing sexual function, reproductive function, that's something which amounts to a tremendous medical scandal, and one which has a particularly grim aspect to it because, as is said in the report, and as has been known for a very long time, the vast, vast majority of these kids, as you say, are same-sex attracted, either gay or bisexual. So what this amounts to has been the sterilisation of hundreds of gender non-conforming, gay, autistic, troubled kids, and that being cheered on by the great and good for years and years, and the people raising concerns about it being demonised and cancelled and censored and so on. So it is a tremendous moment of vindication. The question now is what happens next? Because there's been very many kind of false dawns, I think, in this discussion where it feels like things are going to go back on track. But the trouble that we're now confronted with is that it's been very difficult to dislodge this ideology from these institutions because it is an ideology. It's not just a set of kind of clinical protocols which turned out to be a bit shonky. It's the fact that there are people, not just in the health service, but in the media and government, who are really given to this almost ersatz religion at this point. So whilst there has been a very kind of welcome kind of cracking open of the debate as a consequence of this report, it's impossible to ignore. The task ahead of us is still pretty tremendous, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. What have you made of this, Ella?
Yeah, I mean, you take your victories when they come. And I think lots of people breathed a sigh of relief of having that official stamp from, you know, former head of the Royal College of Paediatricians, Hilary Cass, you know, squeaky clean record, nobody can touch her. Doing this very thorough and actually very even-handed review. I mean, you have to be fair to her. She does make a big point of something which sometimes the gender critical side can maybe miss, which is that, you know, there are a lot of confused kids out there who are stuck on waiting lists, who aren't getting seen for whatever reason, and that's not a good thing, you know. And she's quite open about the failings in the NHS, which is an important part of this. But a bit like Tom said, I mean, outlining the medical inadequacies, which I think most people knew, which is if you stop puberty, it's going to do something weird to your body. Mm. And you know, even the fact of trying to convince it's impossible to get a 14-year-old or even a 16-year-old to understand what it'd be like to not be able to have kids or to not be able to have an orgasm, you know, because they're not interested in that because they don't know sexual life. How would they understand it? You don't understand it until you do it. So all of that is sort of, it's good to have it, as you say, in black and white. But I think there is also, you know, should be a bit of soul searching outside of the medical profession, because it's the medical scandal, then there's the social scandal of, you know, why is it that so many adults have felt unable to say no to children? Parents, but that's a complicated sort of area, but teachers, social workers, you know, a lot of these kids will have come through CAMHS, child mental health services. And one really interesting thing that Cass outlines in the review is, and it's just really stark to have it written there, is that 15 years ago you had about 50 cases, and it was, she said, it was a mainly birth registered boys, so boys who want to become girls, and today it's, you know, thousands, with 3,000 girls wanting to become boys. And why didn't anyone at any point say in GIDS, Tavistock or wherever, hang on a minute, there's something going on here that's not lots of people authentically wanting to change their gender, there's something else? And I think it would be wrong for us to come out of the Cash Review and say this was just a sort of medical scandal, or it was just a big mental health scandal. There's lots of people who are saying this is just abuse of autistic kids and things like that. I think also we have to address the sort of social contagion element to it, which is that there are lots of these girls are attention-seeking teenagers, and I mean that in the best way. We all were once, and that's teenagers' prerogative to be like that. But what is missing is the adults in the room who came along and said, enough is enough now. You're not going to get to call yourself Sam, and you're going to stop this now. You know, and just sort of was sensible. So it's the common sense thing that's missing. And I think that's what's going to have to be important to keep talking about, because social transition isn't going to stop in schools because of the Cash Review. Private clinics can still deliver some of this treatment despite what the Cash Review has said. There are these regional hubs opening up, giving, you know, which doesn't seem to have much oversight. Certainly there's no CAS in there making sure that the same kind of failures and treatment continue. So it, you know, it's just the start, I suppose. It's a good start. We should celebrate. Everybody who's been arguing about this should buy themselves a big pint. But it's certainly not the end.
No, definitely. And one of the things that I think has been really interesting is the response, or I suppose lack of response, from so many of the organisations that have been involved in pushing this idea that, you know, we need gender-affirming care for children. If they don't get it, then you're killing trans kids because they'll commit
suicide. Another statistic, incidentally, that the report rebuffs, exactly. Many people would have already known.
But so many of these organisations that have pushed that idea haven't really had that much to say about the CAS review. The response to it has been pretty muted. And you even have people like, for example, the Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, saying that, you know, it's good that the report specifically avoided this sort of like culture war aspect of the trans issue. And the report itself saying, you know, it doesn't want to get into the toxic debate around the trans question. But isn't this also a problem in and of itself, like referring back to the trans issue as being a sort of culture war problem?
Yeah, absolutely. I found that response repugnant. I think it serves different functions when people say it's a cultural and it's been really toxic. In some cases, I think this report and that excuse is their way of quietly admitting that they were wrong, whilst trying to pretend that there were these two extremes out there who were being really unreasonable. Fine, whatever it needs to get you over the line. But I think more problematic is when people are saying that and dismissing the people who actually brought this to public attention. So because of this toxic debate, we have the CAS review. Because there were individuals, beginning with whistleblowers in the Tavistock 20 years ago, who were willing to put their heads above the parapet and saying what was going on here is wrong, It's because of those journalists, campaigners, politicians in some cases, who were willing to say the unsayable and face really severe personal and career costs for that. It's because of them that we have this report in the first place. So to kind of wave all of that away and just pretend like there are these two extremes and they were screaming at each other and now we've come through the middle, I think is incredibly unseemly and ungrateful in many respects. But also the big problem with it is that it pretends as if both sides look as bad as each other. This debate in the main was one side, which had the ear and the seal of approval of the National Health Service, of both political parties, of the vast tranche of the media, was saying that it's a good idea to subject confused youngsters to life-changing treatments off the basis of terrible evidence that was pushed by basically activist organisations posing as professional bodies. That it was the people, these people were also saying that you can get rid of women's rights, you can get rid of women's spaces, all these kinds of things. And then the ones who turn up and say, hang on a minute here, they're the ones who are being really toxic and have turned this into a culture war. I think it's absolutely ridiculous. And I think hopefully what we're going to start to see now is those gender critical voices getting more of a hearing in the mainstream. Because whilst I think the alternative media, places like Spikes, people setting up their own platforms, has been tremendously important to bringing this story to where it is now. I mean, many of us were covering this story before the BBC or anyone else would touch it. At the same time, unfortunately, for the kind of mainstream institutions to change, you're going to require that kind of mainstream media debate. That's the only thing they pay attention to. So I'm hoping that that will begin to shift. And it was interesting, just on the morning that the report came out, voices who you'd seen basically blackballed from those kinds of arenas suddenly getting a hearing, and not just because they've been booked so they can be hissed at by someone. So yes, the allegations of it being toxic and being a cultural and whatever, I think is, I get why they're doing it, but they should stop, because it's being, as I say, tremendously ungrateful to a group of people who have helped unearth a, not just a significant medical scandal, but as Ella was saying, a tremendous moral failing on the part of society.
A lot of the conversation has also sort of revolved around, will this actually shift the tide against this sort of medicalizing of children? Or has it? Is it the case that this rot, so to speak, has sort of run too deep now?
Well, it's sort of a bit of both. I don't want to undermine the importance of the cat review. I think it is, you know, I think it can be very useful in terms of just having that professional, expert, well-respected input into this debate. But for all the young people who, thousands of young people who are still looking for these kind of treatments and pushing these kind of, pushing their parents, pushing, you know, as teenagers do, their therapists and stuff, to put them on these kind of pathways, there is still Mermaid, Stonewall, there is still the kind of general consensus that whether or not you actually get the pills, that you are right to think you are in the wrong body, that this is an okay view to have. And so I kind of want us to get harsher. Yeah, I want us to get harsher with kids, or more tough love, and actually be able to have the confidence to set the boundaries that need to be set in this discussion. You know, there will always be cases where someone genuinely is wanting to live a different identity. And there are, you know, I'm not doubting the cases of people who've grown up to be trans and are now 35 and living very happy lives. That's absolutely fine. But the vast majority of people aren't like that. This isn't something that is as, you know, akin to having same-sex attraction or something like that. It's a very severe thing, an extreme thing, what feeling that you hate your own body. I think we just need to get better at, more confident as adults, at being able to say to, a bit like eating disorders or self-harm, this is a terrible thing that you're saying right now, that you want to change bits of yourself, not just cut your hair, but cut bits
but it
of
has,
yourself
it's been
off.
The opposite as well, because it was a lot of the supposed adults who have been pushing this stuff. I mean, that's one thing that the CAST report touched on, which many people have been aware of, is the phenomenon of kind of influencers on social media, even going as far as, you know, giving instructions as to how to respond in a interview or in a discussion with your clinician in order to go to get the puberty blockers or the cross-sex hormones that you desire. But there's also these institutions in general, because I think, I'm sure a lot of concerned parents showed up at a Tavistock clinic or just wanting to kind of defer to the expertise. The problem is the expertise was completely built on sand. I mean, it seems that, and again Cass underlines this, that a lot of this comes from WPATH, which has recently been exposed for its own dreadful lack of evidence for its procedures, and much worse. was basically just kind of laundering this nonsense throughout various Western health systems. And the only ones that the report says that have got good guidelines are the countries who have reviewed it in light of the whole gender controversy. And that's one of the things that's so striking, is the number of supposed adults in the room, quite literally, who were not only just sort of going along with this, but actually actively promoting it. Mm. And that's one thing that I find really quite troubling, is the how so many of the people, particularly in the media, it's almost like it was more important to them that they virtue signaled, you know, demonstrate themselves as on the side of this oppressed minority, raging and railing against this supposed dreamt up kind of transphobic backlash. That was more important to them than thinking about this for at least 30 seconds to work out whether or not this was a good idea. They would much rather that all of these, you know, were implicitly that all of these confused kids were pushed towards these irreversible life-changing treatments because it burnished their own ego. Like, that is so much of so many of the problems that we talk about these days, is because people would rather not think about something, mouth the platitudes, and allow these things to go on because it makes them feel good about themselves rather than it actually treats the people they're going to care about.
Yeah, and you know, you'd want maybe a few more apologies. Mm. Dr. David Bell, who was the original whistleblower at the Tavistock, was on Channel 4 News last night and was fabulous. But challenged the person he was sort of on with, who was continuing to give treatment, not quite hormone blockers, but was quite defiant, mm-hmm. saying we will still continue to give treatment. And he just said to him, do you not have any regret? Do you not have if you look at what's happened to all these kids, do you not have any regret? And 4 years ago for Spiked, I interviewed Marcus and Susan mm-hmm. Evans, who was a couple who were, Susan was a psychiatrist and Marcus was one of the sort of head honchos at the Tavistock. And they both left and have been instrumental in Keira Bell's case and speaking out. And they made a really important point, which was that, like Tom says, there was a sort of, there was an attitude within GIDS, a sort of, not just personal egos, but also sort of the idea that the Tavistock would become the gender identity clinic. There was this sort of drive for a sense that it would be the best, never mind what was happening to young people. But also they made the point that that was mixed in with the fact that there was such an onslaught of patients, thousands. Imagine, you know, in the space of 7-10 years, you've got thousands of kids coming when only there was sort of a trickle. That there was this sort of drive to prescribe, but also a sort of classic NHS wave them through attitude to it. And it meant that you had, they told us in the interview, that you had situations in which kids would be put on medical pathways after 2 1-hour interviews. Yeah, yeah. You know, and the important thing that Cass says is that there is no other, you know, area of healthcare, from, you know, ingrown toenails being removed to anything else, where you get this kind of unevidenced, you know, uncautious treatment. I mean, you have to go through 7 appointments to get anything done in the NHS. It's mad that this was happening at such a rate. So,
and also the conspiracy of silence around it is something which has been there from the very beginning, because you talk about Susan Evans, who blew the whistle back in 2004.
Yeah.
2004, yeah. At that point, you know, Julie Bindle was right for The Guardian, Graham Linehan was the toast of Islington, J.K. Rowling was like a beloved children's author, and the only people who thought she was the devil were like crazy Christians in America. Like, it was a long time ago, and it took a lot of courage to say it then. But ever since then, the pattern in the Tavistock Clinic was to ignore those whistleblowers, to try and just, you know, pretend like what was going on wasn't a problem. And also the Cass Review itself makes a point of talking about how her research and the research at the University of York had this team that were reviewing all of the evidence and all of the data were, in her words, thwarted by the adult gender clinics, who just refused to give up any information. So that one of the scandals going on is like, where is all the follow-up data? But then there's also this question about what they're not even giving, what it is that they claim to have. So that conspiracy of silence around something is around this should have always made people suspicious. But again, the way in which they were, these services were just allowed to carry on, even though they were acting in a way which no other area of practice would, that's definitely a huge question for the NHS. And it's impossible to conclude that that's not got something to do with, obviously, fear. There's a lot of this kind of sense of not wanting to engage with this topic, not wanting to think about it seriously, but also ideology. And I think that's one thing that makes all these problems much more difficult to dislodge, is that they are given to, whether it's because they just like to virtue signal, they kind of believe the tenets of this sort of ersatz religion, they were happy to let it carry on, even though it went against all their supposed like principles and practices and protocols and everything.
If you're fed up with your 9-to-5, you might be thinking about starting your own business. Working for yourself can be super rewarding and give you so much freedom. But becoming your own boss is easier said than done. Luckily, there's a solution, and it sounds like this. Yes, that's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the revolutionary all-in-one commerce platform that gives you the means to turn your business idea into a reality. Shopify supports millions of aspiring business owners like you all over the world. Whether you're trading in king-size beds or tailored threads, Shopify can streamline how you deliver your products, both in-store and online. Now, I know what you're thinking. How does this actually work? Well, Shopify supports your business with a simple point-of-sale system and an all-in-one digital setup. Plus, Shopify will market your social media spaces like Facebook and TikTok. So no matter where you are or what you're selling, Shopify will help you reach your customers. The best part is that Shopify puts you at the heart of your business. You can customize pretty much everything, so no need to worry about blending in with the competition. Shopify's endless customization tools ensure that your brand image is always in your hands. So what are you waiting for? If you're serious about running your own business, you need to try Shopify. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/spiked, all lowercase. Go to shopify.co.uk/spiked to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.co.uk/spiked. So it seems that only a few weeks ago we were talking about Abdel Azidi, the case of an asylum seeker who committed this horrendous chemical attack on a woman and her daughters. Turns out that he was previously convicted of a sexual offence here in the UK. Two sexual offences here in the UK, and yet was still allowed to be granted asylum. And this week it's come out that there has been a similar case of a man who was convicted of a sexual offence back in 2017 involving exposure. And yet again, he was somehow still granted asylum. I think the court said that there was too great a risk that he would face mob violence if he was returned to his home country in Afghanistan. And yet it seems perfectly okay that he's allowed to remain here, even when, as was admitted in the court hearing, that he still poses a risk to women here in the UK. So yeah, Tom, what have you made of this? Why does this keep happening?
It was crazy enough when we found out that there were cases like Abdel Azid where someone was being granted asylum, allowed to stay despite having committed sexual offences in this country. The fact that someone has been allowed to stay almost because they have committed sexual offences in this country is absolutely incredible. The circular logic is absolutely deranging. The idea that someone, whilst in the process of fighting their own asylum claim, have committed this act, and because of the fact that their, quote, risky behaviours might subject them to trouble if they're taken back to Afghanistan, is going to strike most people as absolutely ridiculous. I mean, I think part of this also we should understand is the kind of intellectual gymnastics that go on when people are trying to fight these claims. But the fact that these are taken seriously by a judge and that someone is allowed to stay on this basis is absolutely insane. And when you stack it along the cases that we've been talking about previously, when obviously there's Abdel Azidi, that's been well documented, some of the other situations in which people have been granted leave to remain on human rights grounds, including a Sudanese ISIS propagandist, an Albanian crime lord who was allowed to stay on the basis of his right to a family life. It does get to the point where it's like, what do you have to do to get deported in this particular country? And one thing that's interesting about the Sky News reporting about this, which unveiled this, but also some more details about Azedi recently, which we've talked about, is it also talks about the broader dysfunction in the system. So about half of appeals seem to be eventually granted, or at least half of asylum seekers have managed to overturn their refusal to stay. And that also, even when it's been decided that they should be removed, and only in two-thirds of cases that just doesn't really take place. Now, I think it's important to say that the idea, and Luke Gittos made this point in this podcast last week, that it's just this wonderful kind of open-door system and that people are all kind of taking advantage of it. It's not that simple. It's such a dysfunctional system that even really worthy cases, to use that phrase, awful phrase, often still find themselves caught up in it. If you talk to anyone who's been involved in trying to resettle the Afghan refugees who do have a right to come here, who do not have loads of sexual offences on their record, who, you know, risk life and limb supporting British and Allied forces and so on, the purgatory that they've been trapped in, even when they're here, is tremendous. So it's not like that. But what we seem to have is a system which is allowing people like Abdel Azidi or this individual to stay here, whilst also failing those people. So I think it just shows that the dysfunction is really needs to be tackled precisely if we want a liberal but sane asylum system. And it seems that one is becoming a big block to the other. And also I think it's becoming a big block to public support for it, because people are starting to wonder, not without cause, if this system is so dysfunctional that it's actually putting British citizens' lives at risk. And in that context, it's very difficult to land an argument for any kind of more generous arrangement as we might want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was in the sort of reports of this man who's been granted asylum, there was a story of a woman from Zimbabwe who has been appealing for 18 years and, you know, has, you know, could have had her asylum, but she was a political refugee, could have had her case open and closed very quickly and then be living a life as a British citizen with all the benefits and responsibilities that affords, and, you know, not having such a weight hanging over her head over whether or not she's going to be deported. But like Tom says, that's, I mean, unbelievable that that's not sorted, and, you know, mass number of appeals. And at the same time, you then have these cases who seem to be sort of waved through. There's a, you know, it actually, I think, boils down to quite a boring, in some cases, a sort of boring explanation of just deep inadequacy within the processing system, which is that, you know, I don't want to sound like Jacob Rees-Mogg, but you do have this sort of crisis in the civil service of them not actually want, you know, lots of them not actually wanting to work, caseloads going missing, proper filing not being done. I mean, we know that that's what happened, for example, in relation to the Windrush scandal, and a lot of it is happening in relation to Afghans at the moment. But there's also this kind of, I think, sort of politically, the problem is that the notion of asylum seeker has taken on this great moral weight of, if you're an asylum seeker, it doesn't matter what you've done, what the context is, you, and the word refugee, you are ultimate victim. You know, there was that whole, it's sort of that sort of overblown narrative of victimhood began in 2017 when you had the massive problem of Syrian refugees and the death of that little boy, Island Kurdi, and all that kind of thing. And I think that's really infected the way in which people who are working in the asylum system approach it, which is that there is this sort of moral blackmail. I mean, how else do you explain allowing a flasher to come and stay here because him being a flasher is a danger to him? I mean, how else do you explain that other than the idea that the sort of victim narrative is being weaponized to such an extent? You know, obviously this more broadly in relation to illegal immigration, we see this sort of, you know, return with sort of people who, you've got, you know, Albanian economic migrants who are just young men looking to try and get a good job or whatever, and a fair play to them. But
or being, just trying to get over and work in the black market. Yeah, sometimes
being,
the case.
Being labelled as, you know, these terrible, victimised, worthy of sympathy, you know, and so it just completely clouds what we need, which is a very cool-headed judgment and assessment of who should come in and who shouldn't. And as Tom says, I completely agree. At that point, you can then start winning over people to the argument that we mm-hmm. could and should be, and have the facilities to be open and generous in relation to this. But you, at the moment, it's like you're shadow boxing, because no one within the asylum system, nobody who has the power to make things happen, whether it's judges or politicians, seem to want to grapple with this issue, which is that we're lying and using the wrong kind of terms for what we're talking about, because there is this sort of moral blackmail going on about what's going on with immigration.
And that's weird willful naivety as well. I mean, you saw that reflected in the Azedi case and the various kind of reverends who vouched on his behalf, and people who pointed out that there was, you know, there's a lot of people on the Booby Stockholm convert to Christianity. Do you reckon some of them might be doing it just to stay here? I've got no reason to believe that. I mean, maybe you could take that from, you know, a man of faith who desperately hopes that he's saving souls and whatnot. But the fact that the system generally judges people working on these cases are giving into this idea that these people are almost like all angels by definition is ridiculous. It's also, I mean, it's naive in the sense that, like, the idea that any of them could just be coming here for the sake of economic migration, as if no one would ever think to do that, is naive. But it's also, it's kind of dehumanizing at the same time. It's this idea that they're not real human beings like the rest of us. There's not going to be ones who are lying. There's not going to be ones that are telling the truth. There's not going to be ones who are here for good reasons and ones who are here for bad reasons. They just become this kind of symbol. And again, it's a bit like what we were talking about earlier, where, and part of the reason why so many politicians have said such ridiculous things on this, on some of these cases and some of these particular issues, is you know, it's almost impossible for them to concede that any of that there might be something wrong, or that some of these people maybe shouldn't be here. Like, that's just is something that they're not willing to dare utter because it would just make them look bad. That seems to be the only reason. But the fact that that is happening across the whole scale of the system, this isn't just about politicians virtue signaling on Newsnight, shows how, what a kind of deep and sort of intractable problem that is, I guess.
So the other topic that I want to get onto today is about William Ragg, the Conservative MP, former Conservative MP, now independent, in Hazel Grove in Greater Manchester. It came out last week that he had become embroiled in this sort of honey trap, sex scandal type situation. Essentially what happened was that he was chatting to some guy on Grindr, the gay dating app, and ended up sending some compromising images of himself to this person he was talking with. And that person then used those images as leverage over him, ended up sort of demanding contact details for various other MPs and Westminster staffers and journalists and such. The response to this, I mean, the whole case has been completely bizarre. Obviously, it's not a very clever thing to do if you are a public figure to send, you know, naked images of yourself to random strangers. But the response to this has also been pretty interesting. You have a lot of people saying, you know, we should feel really sorry for him. Yeah. He's a victim in this case.
He's courageous, according to Jeremy.
Yeah, Hunt. Yeah. So you have Chancellor Jeremy Hunt saying that he's courageous, particularly for apologising and coming forward about it.
Is it courage to take a picture of your penis and send it to someone you don't know, may not even exist? Like, that's a kind of courage, but, you know.
Well, yeah.
On a serious note, in any political organisation, the number one rule is that you do not sell out your comrade. I mean, you know, I cannot believe that he was not immediately sacked. That there's, you know, if you are, you know, hanging Lee Anderson for saying something, you know, rude and off colour, if you're, you know, if you look back at the sort of ways in which MPs have had the whip removed for, you know, some things that are slight in comparison to this, compromising the security of your party and security of your political colleagues. I can't believe it. I cannot believe he was not immediately hung, drawn and quartered. Yeah. And I suppose, why wasn't he? Is it because Rishi Sunak is just desperate to not have any scandal, potentially? Maybe it's a sort of self-preservation thing. Maybe it's because Tories, I'm not saying that going on Grindr, there's a problem with going on Grindr, but the sort of level of public degradation that's going, whether it's like tractor porn or all the rest, there is so much sex stuff going on within the Conservative Party at the moment that you just don't want to know about or wish wasn't made public. It's like,
it's always the Conservative Party.
Get on with your job and stop doing these things. And also the fact that lots of people that he gave the numbers of then themselves sent pictures.
There's at least two MPs that they know of. I don't think they've been named as at the time that we're recording this. But is it
just sort of like a don't talk about it non-scandal? Or is it the fact that, to come back to the sort of victim narrative idea, that he can get away with crying publicly and saying, oh, it's so terrible that I was, you know, I was under such pressure. And you think, you're a coward.
It's also weird how, like, people volunteered that excuse almost on his behalf. You know, so it was this sort of sense in which he was keeping relatively tight-lipped, but you just had a lot of people kind of say, you know, he's got a lot of mental health problems and, you know, he's a victim at the end of the day. But I think, you know, there might be all kinds of reasons why Jeremy Hunt felt the need to say that. I don't know what was on Will Ragg's phone that might have related or depicted him. It's a bit confusing. But there is this reflex, I think, which is the sort of the mental health get out, if that's a horrible thing to say. And I think it's a big problem, is that how do you hold politicians properly to account in an era in which that excuse is always there? You know, you can do something horrendous, but you can claim that I was going through a really tough time while it happened. But it's obvious that this, first of all, this is stupid. I mean, there was that case, what was it, 10 years ago with that Tory MP, Brooks Newmark, who people might have forgotten about now, the ridiculous scandal where a journalist, Alex Wickham, now Bloomberg, then somewhere else, posed as a 20-year-old Swedish blonde woman and tried to solicit sex pictures from Brooks Newmark, which he instantly took with his face in the picture and some quite fetching pyjamas. It was like front page news. He was, you know, he was immediately, you know, dispensed with. How could you come back from that? But now it has, because it can be kind of explained away to a certain extent, I suppose. I mean, we should say that now at this point, he stepped down from He was vice chair of the 1922 committees, stepped down. He also had a chairmanship on the select committees. He stepped down from that. He has given back the whip and so on, because the mood changed and people realised how ridiculous it was. But the fact that even at the beginning of this scandal, there was this ready-made excuse and that it kind of could work, it tells you something about the age we live in, definitely. And it's a bad thing, isn't it? I mean, like, you don't have to go down this route that, oh, it could have been the Russians or it could have been, you know, Xi Jinping, to realise that it's a bad thing if your MPs can be that easily blackmailed.
Yeah, well,
which is not a good state of affairs.
I mean, every week there's news about whether or not they're going to ban TikTok or whether they're going to do all these things because national security threats. Mm. And you've got politicians mouthing off to whoever will listen in the bar, and, you know, some of them being potentially Chinese spies. You've got other politicians sending blackmailable images of themselves to complete strangers. So you do think, I mean, I'm not that bothered, you know, interested generally by national security, but hang on a minute, I'm not going to be lectured to you about it if you're compromising it yourselves. Because, you know, on a serious note, if you are giving out information of MPs, it is a safety issue. You know, I think we should take it relatively seriously, despite the fact that it's from these sort of silly beginnings. But I think the most interesting thing is to come back to the sort of question of the sort of mental health victimhood aspect of it, is that, you know, you're supposed to, as a politician, which is meant to be a public service, I don't want to get all worthy about it, but it's meant to mean something. And so I suppose it says something about sort of careerist politicians these days. But there's meant to be some kind of honour in it and some kind of self-sacrifice, which is that I think, particularly in the Conservative Party at the moment, which is obviously imploding, that you just time and again see people working for themselves. And, you know, whether it's Liz Truss getting a new memoir out to go on the after dinner circuit or William Ragg selling out his colleagues, there is no sense of sort of a group of people who are committed to an ideology, whether it's Conservative or Labour, and are fighting for that and wanting to change the world. It's all always so petty, so personal. And I don't want to care about William Ragg's mental health. I shouldn't care about it. It's of no relevance to me. It's not interesting. What is relevant to me is how good a politician he is and what his ideas are. And it feels like the news from Westminster all the time is about personal scandal or personal grievance or who's been bullied, who got hit by John Bercow's phone, who, you know, all this stuff that we don't care about, because all they do is look up their own backsides rather than actually doing something. I know that's a really depressing thought for upcoming general election, but it's true.
There is a problem, though. Like, Westminster loves talking about itself. Like, whether you're talking about the politicians or the lobby journalists or whatever, they love a scandal like this because it's something that is that proper kind of Westminster village gossip, which can perpetuate these things beyond what is necessary. But it does make you think, like, the quality. I don't, you know, not to fetishise just professionalism in politics, but how dim some of these people seem to be is quite alarming. Like, the idea that you would just send these pics, like, oh, I don't know this number, penis picture. Yeah. It doesn't seem to be particularly encouraging. And it's a bit like whenever they have a conversation about anything to do with social media or whatever, it's obviously filtered through their own experience. It's like the number of times that they call for, you know, we need to censor the internet because they don't know how to work out their Twitter settings, basically, because they don't know how to block people. They don't know how to keep the nasty stuff away from them. It just shows that these people who preside over such vast swathes of life now just can't even tie their own shoelaces. It's not good.